Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night.
Live from Las Vegas, it's time for you to be Talking Movies with America's most award-winning film critic, John Barber.
You're being so gentle. I've heard you give reviews and you're so rough, you're saying.
How would you have evaluated your own work in some of the films that you did prior to The Longest Shot? I
mean, much better than you, my friend.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Hi, this is John Barber. Welcome to Talking Movies. And what a joy today's show is really going to be, because it's not just a treat of a couple of talents. It's an absolute buffet of talent. And Doug, how are you today?
I am doing wonderfully well. Thank you, John.
Now, I know that you bowl on the weekends, but I asked you because I know you love music. And you love to sing, and I've had a bunch of viewers say, listen, will that guy go to a karaoke and record something? Have you done that for us yet?
Would you believe I haven't? I'm remiss at that. I don't know if they record anymore. I haven't even taken the time to really go out and do that. I've kind of done bowling and left the music for later.
Well, I certainly wish you would. You know, Socrates said, the unexamined life isn't worth living. But what I say is a life that is not creative or involved with music is not worth living. And I must tell you, our featured guest today, if there were a Mount Rushmore for music in this country, he would be one of the first to adorn it. You are going to be stunned at the Wikipedia of wonderful work this man has done over the decades. I mean, in the 70s, He did the scores, the opening scores, for bunches of our favorite shows: Laverne and Shirley, Love Boat, Love American Style, and even Monday Night Football. He's done over 100 films. Can you believe that? I mean, just phenomenal. And I think one of the first ones he might have done, I think, might have been one of Jane Fonda's first films, Barbarella. Then he did another really good film, 9 to 5. And then Goodbye, Columbus, and The Last American Hero with an absolutely fabulous song called I Got a Name. He's got all kinds of awards and accolades, but I think, to me, bigger than an Academy Award or an Oscar or Grammy or Tony or anything, is a compliment paid to him by the Polish government. They asked him to create a concerto to be played this year in Poland by one of the greatest pianists in the world. And it's for the 200th anniversary of Frederick Chopin. You do not get any bigger than that. And thankfully, the world will get to see him in a documentary to be released soon by another multi-talent. He is a writer, director, and producer, and he's done three wonderful shows that I loved on HBO. One was 100 Voices, A Journey Home, an award winner, A Bronx Tale, and the Super Bob Einstein Show. Now, so the composer has also written his own autobiography called Killing Me Softly. So there you go, a hint at who it is, because he has written the music to one of the greatest love songs in America. So by way of introduction, Doug, introduction, would you play just a little bit of that great song for me?
Strumming my pain with his fingers, singing my life with his words, killing me softly with his song, killing me softly with his song, telling my whole life with his words, killing me softly with his song.
It doesn't get more wonderful than that, and it doesn't get more wonderful for me to be able to introduce the composer, Charles Fox. Charles, how are you? And also, at the same time, I have to introduce the man who is finally telling the documentary about your life, Danny Rose. Where are the both of you, and how are the both of you?
We're great. I would just say that Danny Gold. Just to,
yeah. Not Broadway Danny Rose.
Yeah, no, I didn't want to bring that up, but it brought a smile to my face. There can't be an actual human being successful in this business whose name is Danny Gold. That's the, I think it's the name of the Woody Allen film, which was very, very funny.
Broadway Danny Rose, absolutely.
Yeah, Broadway Danny Rose, that was it. Broadway Danny Rose, that's it.
Well, so first of all, thank you so much for a lovely introduction. It was, I've been a big fan of yours, John, for many years. So it's great to be on the Zoom with you and look forward to meeting in person one day.
So could I start with you, Charles, and Danny, if you don't mind just sitting there and listening a bit, because you'll get some of the same question. If they were making a movie about your life, Charles, where would it start? Where were you born? What were your parents like? Did you have siblings? And it seems to me, from the output of music of yours, you were born to be a musician, but did you wish to do anything else?
No. Honestly, I never had any thoughts of doing anything but music. And actually, when I was born, this is kind of family lore, but you might find it amusing. I was born with a bump in the back of my head that the doctor said to my mother, that was a music bump.
Oh my God, you're kidding.
Did you ever hear of that before? I never did since.
No, I never. That is funny.
Yeah.
Were your parents or grandparents, anybody multi-talented musically?
You know, my father came from Poland. Talk about Poland. Uh-huh. And he played a mandolin, and he played his nice little tunes, little Jewish tunes and, you know, little songs. And he was kind of known as the man with the mandolin, not professionally. It's just something he loved to do. So that was my musical background, hearing the mandolin, just that simple.
And what did you first start tinkling around with as a kid? And how young were you? And what sort of music or musicians inspired you to go in the direction you were going?
I started playing the piano when I was around 8 or 9 years old. And actually, my piano teacher was a very lovely woman who lived. We lived on the ground floor of an apartment house in the Bronx. My piano teacher lived on the fifth floor. And I would simply go up to take the elevator to the fifth floor with $2 neatly tucked in my shirt pocket like this. My lesson. And she was a wonderful woman. And I took lessons with her until I went to the High School of Music and Art when I was about 13. And as far as influences, you know, she actually took me to my first opera. She was also a teacher at a college of music. Uh-huh. And she included me, I was quite young, with the college students whenever she would take them on excursions. And she took us once to NBC to see how a radio show was made. And I still picture that, you know, with the horses going back to radio days. And she took me to see my first opera. It was Prokofiev, Love for Three Oranges. And I still remember that very well. It was a great moment in my life, just to see and are people singing on stage and with movement and an orchestra and beautiful Prokofiev melodies, you know.
Oh, how wonderful. What did your father do for a living?
My father was a window cleaner.
Uh-huh.
And my mother was born in Israel, and they met in the Bronx and were married. And I was the middle of three brothers. And so I'll just say something interesting. I have my good friend, Danny Gold, he was in the middle of now editing the film.
Uh-huh.
But the film, we started this kind of backwards, because one of the last things that I had done, I started my career professionally with Latin music.
Tito Puente?
Well, I discovered Latin music when I was about 15 years old. I was working in a band in the Catskill Mountains. You know, it was a place that many of us got started. Great comics and singers and dancers, all the great comics. All of them got started there, and a lot of musicians too. And a lot of people started as musicians. Hal Linden, for example, is a good friend of mine. He started as a musician and became a great actor, as we all know.
Fred McMurray started as a musician.
Who did?
The actor, Fred McMurray.
Oh, is that so?
Yeah, and my third professional job, my manager was Jerry Weintraub. My third professional job was in the Catskills.
Is that true?
Now, you have two brothers. Are they musical at all?
Well, coincidentally, unfortunately, my older brother passed a few years ago. We were all involved in some way in music, in show business and theater. My older brother was a producer. Uh-huh. He produced musicals like Sophisticated Ladies on Broadway.
Wow, how wonderful. Yeah.
And he had his own record company, actually. My younger brother, coincidentally, also got into Latin music, and he engineered most of the great Latin music records of the late 60s into the 70s. So it's funny how we all kind of ended up like this. Several years ago, 3 years ago, I was invited because of my Latin music background. And I one day said to a friend, I wanted to make another Latin record. I hadn't made a Latin record since I was quite young, in my early 20s. And shortly after that, I had a call from the Minister of Culture of Cuba asking me if I would come there and do some concerts. So, of course, I said yes. I was happy to do that. My friend Danny, who is a wonderful director, filmmaker, he said, I want to film that. That sounds interesting. And so that's how it started. And then, so you ask about where did my life start? Only recently, after a lot of filming, which I will tell you about, a lot of filming in Cuba, Paris, Fontainebleau, France, all over, California, obviously, Danny said, I really want to film you where it all started. And I'll let you tell the story.
Oh, well, we went to the Bronx and, you know, filmed on the street, Sedgwick Avenue, where Charlie lived and where certain transitional events happened for his life, that it was really great to have him there experiencing it and telling, you know, our cameras about it. So it was a really nice touch.
Yeah, but let me ask you the same question. I have a couple of more questions about you personally, Charles, before we get to that. So let's go to Danny now.
Yeah.
Danny, your background, your parents, your family, and what led you to get into film?
Well, my family had nothing to do with show business in any way. What led me to get into film was on my 9th birthday, I got a Super 8 movie camera and a love affair began.
Oh my God, so did Spielberg when he was 8, went in the backyard.
I was 1 year too late.
That's wonderful. And then it's stuff that you do, the stuff that I saw on HBO is fantastic. But I want to just put you on hold a second because I have a couple of personal questions to Charles. Charles, what were your parents' attitude about the possibility of you earning a living as a musician? And did you meet your wife before you could make a living and support her, or after you were more successful?
You know, my parents, right from the get-go, were completely supportive. I went to the High School of Music and Art. It was a wonderful school of the arts, and combined later on, years later, with the High School of the Performing Arts. And for the last 30 years, there's been the LaGuardia High School of the Arts in New York, probably the preeminent school of the arts and high school students. And there, I met a lot of other wonderful musicians. I was influenced by classical people, jazz musicians. Suddenly, everyone played the piano that I knew, you know. And when I was young and after school, a lot of my friends would go play basketball. I did that sometimes, but I would usually run home to practice the piano. So I met a lot of other people like that. My parents never considered, is this something you can really earn a living? If it was something I wanted to do and loved, they were just behind it. So after high school, and I'll tell you how this played out after high school, I really didn't want to go to a conservatory or college. So I kept studying privately with my composition teacher from high school, my orchestration teacher, and I was playing with bands in New York, Latin bands. I had the opportunity that my original piano teacher mentioned Nadia Boulanger in Paris. And I never heard her name before, but then I found out that she was this extraordinary teacher who had taught Aaron Copland early on and generations of composers. So I had the opportunity to go to France, Fontainebleau, France. It's in the Palace of Fontainebleau. It's about 40 miles outside of Paris. And it was a 1,000-year-old palace. It was Napoleon's summer home. And there was a conservatory in the summer. And I applied. I was accepted. And my parents had no business paying for this. They couldn't afford it to send me to France. But they were so much behind me and my musical endeavors that they said, go, we'll figure it out. So they sent me to France when I was 18 years old. And they supported me. I came back when I was 21. And the second part of your question, I met my wife, Joan, when I came home from France. I needed to earn some money now. I'm 21 years old. I can't keep being supported. So I went to the Catskill Mountains again. I had a job. And fortunately, my wife, Joan, was a counselor at the camp. And truly, it was love at first sight for me. It was love at first sight.
Oh, my gosh.
We're coming up, by the way, I'll just say it's our 60th anniversary in September.
Oh, my God. So when you first met Joan, did you write her a love song?
I didn't even think of writing anyone a song. I didn't think of myself as a songwriter, to be honest. I did write Latin songs. I thought of myself as hoping to become a composer, learning the craft of musical composition. I didn't know what direction it would take. I became friendly with Dizzy Gillespie, and he invited me to come to his house and watch his rehearsals. And I ended up writing a lot of things for Dizzy Gillespie. I was doing Latin. I was going to the Metropolitan Opera to see opera at night and concerts. I didn't know what direction it would take.
Well, because when you look at your body of work, it's like whatever you think of, you do. I mean, it's like you can do absolutely anything. How many children do you and Joan have?
We have 3 children and 7 grandchildren.
And the 3 children, anyone in music?
Well, my oldest son is he plays piano beautifully, by the way, and he does write songs. He's a screenwriter. He's written some wonderful movies. My middle son is in business. My daughter is an attorney. She's a prosecutor.
Oh, how interesting. Okay, Danny, in doing this documentary, did you go to Paris to sort of relive or shoot Charles when he was between 18 and 21?
Absolutely. The idea was, you know, we've, from a geographic standpoint, we've been to every area that sort of Charlie existed in. And Paris was such a transformational time in his musical career or his beginnings. And in reading his autobiography, which I recommend, that you really see the importance of meeting and studying with Nadia Boulanger and the effect that it had on his whole life. Now, sure, you can make a documentary. I could stick a camera in his face and tell me about it. But if I could take him to the spot where it happened, if I could take him to the apartment where he studied with her.
Oh, wow.
Or Fontainebleau, the conservatory where he studied with her, the level of recollection and effect that it will have on him telling that story is what I wanted to capture, because then I think the audience will also be more engaged.
Now let's get to the business of how I first heard of you, Charlie, in the 70s was the wonderful theme songs that you wrote in television. So did that come to you easily from people who approached you, or did you have to pursue it? Were you playing in a band at the time? What was going on in your life at that time?
So you mentioned Barbarella. Barbarella was my second film with Jane Fonda, obviously. I did that film with Bob Crewe, one of the great record producers, songwriters. If you see Jersey Boys, those are all his co-writer of all those songs, as well as he discovered and produced the Four Seasons records. So he brought me on to do Barbarella together. He wasn't a composer, he was a lyricist, really. So I did the score, and together we wrote five or six songs. And just like that, I became a songwriter. I didn't expect to do that.
Hear Barbarella and then think, hey, maybe this guy could write some stuff for television?
Well, so the very first picture, that was the second, was a picture called The Incident, the black and white film about two tough guys terrorizing a subway car in the 60s. And my dear friend Larry Pierce was the first of a number of pictures I did together with Larry. His next picture was Goodbye Columbus.
Yes.
And so when I did Barbarella, I did that in New York. The folks at Paramount in California didn't know who I was at all. I was just brought in by Bob Crewe. And so they sent the head of the music department, they sent Hollywood film editors, people to work with me. And as a result of that, of seeing me work, then Larry Pierce was able to bring me on to Goodbye Columbus, which was Stanley Jaffe's production. And so my entree to Hollywood was to come out to score Goodbye Columbus, to compose the score and conduct it in California.
It is a terrific film and a fabulous score. So when you, I guess you say Barbarella was your first or your second?
It was my second film, yes. The first was The Incident. The
black and white one.
A black and white one, exactly right, yeah.
Okay, now when you look at the film, how do you work? How does a musician like you work? Do you have to lock yourself up privately and just look and look and look at the film until something occurs to you?
Well, pretty much so. I mean, I usually see a film many times. It usually hits me in terms of what the needs of the films are musically. And then, of course, I'm not alone. I work with the director. So then I go through the film with the director, give him my ideas of where I think music belongs, where it should go, where it should end, and where what I could possibly hope to help with it, whether it's underscoring a love scene, a dramatic scene, or bringing out some other summer, something more subliminal, something under the surface, you know. I think of myself as a storyteller, if you want to know the truth. And I do that with music. I tell the stories of the film. I try to enhance the film and sometimes stay away from the music so that I don't get in the way of the characters. You know, that hits me.
In doing this, you must have, because you lived through the same era of wonderful black and white movies that I did. I mean, Psycho would not exist without that scene in the shower. Yeah. And Hitchcock didn't want it. It was his wife who made him stick it in there. He absolutely did not want it. He did not want it. That's in a really good film about Hitchcock, by the way. So how do you then go from the darkness of the incident to the light and fluffy stuff of sitcoms.
You know, it was always a great concern to me not to get stereotyped in one way or another. There are people who've gotten stereotyped doing only comedies or only deep, dark, heavily dramatic or intense or, you know, those kind of pictures. I've always enjoyed, you said it before about me, I love the different challenges. I love to go from one thing to another and not to get stuck in any one era. But I'll tell you that, so when I came out to do Goodbye Columbus, at the end of it, the head of the music department, Paramount Pictures, said to me, we have a pilot of a new show. Would you stay around another month or two in California? I was still living in New York, although I brought my wife and two children out at that time to be with me. And we have a new pilot, and I think you would be the right person to score. That was Love American Style.
Oh, my God.
So I did that. I went back to New York. I got the call one day that it's a series. Now we need you to come back. And that was the start. But I have to tell you, so I did that. There were two, I work with Gary Marshall. You know, Gary Marshall is one of the writers on Love America Style. But Gary Marshall did Happy Days.
Yeah.
And of course, I did Happy Days for him and two other wonderful friends, Tom Miller and Eddie Milkus. And I did a lot of their shows like Happy Days, like Angie, like I did a lot of pilots you may not even heard of. One day they were doing a movie because now I felt I was getting stereotyped doing only comedies, and they were successful shows. I really couldn't complain. One day they had a movie called Women in Chains with Ida Lupino.
Oh my God, you're kidding.
I think it was on the lot at Paramount. And it was about a woman who was in prison, and Ida Lupino was a tough prison guard. So I said to them, I really want to do this picture. I never used to do that. I had an agent, of course. But I said to my dear friends, I really want to do Women in Chains. I think that I could do a really good job for that. And they said, well, we know you. I mean, you know, we love you. But can you do a dramatic film? Because they had known me only from these other comedic things. And I said, well, my first picture was The Incident. That was as dramatic as... So they said, all right, well, then you do it. We'd love you to do that. At the same time, we have another show. now I can't think with the gorilla and the theme. Oh, son of a gun. I can't remember it. Would you do that as well? So I agreed to do. I was called The Chimp and I. it was about Tom.
Ted Bessel. Oh, Me and the Chimp.
So it was originally called The Chimp and I, Chimp and I. But then Ted Bessel didn't want to take second billing to The Chimp. So it's called Me and the Chimp. So they said, all right, you can do Women in Chains if you also will do Me and the Chimp.
Did Ida Lupino direct that film? She was a very smart woman.
No, she did not direct it. She was starred in it. That may have been the very last picture. She was not young.
Oh, my goodness gracious. Now, Danny, are some of these things and these experiences shown in your documentary?
I'm sorry. You mean taking Charlie to Paris?
Well, that you've explained. But this business of Women in Chains as being one of the things that he chose to do to be independent. You know, you're only the second artist I've heard really say that out loud who was becoming successful, not want to be stereotyped. And the first was Dustin Hoffman.
Yeah.
Because after his first film.
Graduate. The Graduate.
Yeah, the Graduate. He said, no, not this. And he went to do Midnight Cowboy.
Yes, I know that very well, yeah. Yeah. He was fantastic in both pictures.
Oh, he was fantastic in anything he does. And your music is fantastic. And it captures the essence of anything that you do. For you, Danny, what was the high point for, or is the high point going to come up when Charles gets to go to Poland later in the year? What is the high point for you? And maybe what was the toughest part to shoot for you?
So I will just say, if I can answer that, and I'll let him finish it.
Okay.
Danny and I met actually in Poland in 2009. He was working on a film
called 100 Voices, A Journey Home.
Oh, what a wonderful film. Yes, A Journey Home. You won an Emmy or something for that?
No, we won some film festivals, but it was released in the theaters. And it was a beautiful story, and meeting Charlie there in Poland, and you know, we struck up a friendship, but also from a story standpoint, what he did there was he composed what would you call it?
An oratory
With the words from Pope John Paul II, and he debuted that at the Warsaw Opera House. And it was so dramatic. But what I loved in working with Charlie on that film was he went back to the village where his father came from. And I think he was the first Fox to go back to the actual town and to walk around the town where Charlie's father came from and experience it through Charlie's lens, so to speak, was really something that showed me, first of all, how much I love working with this guy, but also what a great story he has. And I think you mentioned it, you know, the diversity of his career makes it interesting. Everything he's done from the, you know, the game show themes to the TV theme, to the film scores, to operas, to ballets, he just has excelled so much. I've never seen a career excel in so many different areas. So when he says he doesn't want to be stereotyped, you can underline that.
How were you contacted by a government to compose something?
So I'll tell you how that happened. So we were in Poland. I had written an oratorio based on the words of Pope John Paul II. They were beautiful and touching words. He was my lyricist, so to speak. And I conducted the Polish National Opera Company. We had 100 voices, 40 children voices, and 100-piece orchestra that Danny captured magnificently in this film called 100 Voices, if anyone wants to see that. While I was there, the Minister of Culture, who was also the head of the opera, said to me one day, it's not this year coming up, by the way, it was 2010 that it was his actual 200th anniversary of Chopin. And the Minister of Culture said to me, so I would love you to consider writing a piece, homage to Chopin. Would you please consider it? I said, all right, I've considered it, I'll do it. So he said, no, seriously, would you give us some thought? I said, I've given it all the thought I need.
Hold it. Did I get it wrong when I said you were commissioned to have it played this year?
I'll tell you why you're not wrong, though. So forgive me for just, you know, maybe be corrected. 2010 was the actual year that we did that in Poland, in Gdańsk.
And that's in the film that Danny shot?
That part of it will be in the film, yeah.
Oh, my God, how thrilling.
And actually, I conducted two of the great, Leszek Mostow is one of the great pianists in Poland. And Eddie Daniels was one of the greatest jazz clarinetists of all time. I wrote a piece for those two with the chamber orchestra. We had 22,000 people standing and watching this concert. And that is part of the film. Yes, that'll be part of the film. But just this, about 2 or 3 weeks ago, the school that I went to in France in the Palace of Fontainebleau was celebrating the 100th anniversary of the conservatory. And they did a big concert in New York, really just literally a few weeks ago. And they asked me to conduct that same piece that we did in Poland for this concert. So I just did this currently, 2 weeks ago, again, performed in New York, and it's always great to have music performed again. And
how just wonderful. Okay, so let me ask you a couple of questions about in composing something to celebrate Chopin. Did you ever see the movie with Cornel Wilde?
Yes, of course.
Okay, so let me ask you this. How could you avoid putting in some notes that sounded like the Polonaise?
That's just one of many extraordinary works that Chopin did.
And you know the pop song.
The which one?
The pop song that Perry Como made a number one hit.
Oh, well.
Till the end of time.
Yes. A number of times over the years, songwriters have taken themes from, from Borodin's music to Take My Hand, You're a Stranger in Paradise, from the Borodin Stranger in Paradise, I think it was. That happens. In my case, I didn't use any of Chopin's music, but I wrote very Chopinistic style piano, and that went into jazz, that went into more exciting kind of things. But I would say I was just influenced by the music of Chopin and the pianistic style of Chopin, which is very much his own style of, because he was not only the great composer, that he performed his own music as well. When Chopin would come to Paris to perform, it was the hottest ticket in town, you might say. It was like Billy Joel now in New York, and the kings themselves of France would bargain to get the best tickets.
Oh, that's when true artists were really celebrated. I mean, when Charles Dickens went to New York, 25,000 people met him at the boat. I mean, who would ever go to meet an artist today in America? My God. And just a little thing about Poland. My son went to Poland a little over 2 years ago. And my son was a Caucasian Tiger Woods, and he should have been on tour, but he couldn't putt. But he kept the journal, and he wrote about the adventures of being a solo golfer, trying to make it on the tour, but he couldn't putt. So he gave up, and he went to Hollywood, and he started as a gopher. He ended up as co-executive producer and writer two shows, Criminal Minds and CSI. And they're bringing back Criminal Minds, and he's going to do that again. He said, but a couple of years ago when they went on hiatus, he got a call from Poland's leading production company and wanted him to come over there and help him write some crime dramas, okay? So he was thrilled to go. He didn't understand a word of Polish. He hadn't been there a week, Charles, and he called me. And he says, Dad, you'll never believe how good a tomato really tastes. How good a potato really tastes. He said, my God, I could live in this place.
I have to agree. The fruit is pretty good there.
Really oh, is. My gosh, almighty. So you
we used to preservatives here. You know, we get foods, a lot of preservatives. In Europe, mostly they don't, all over Europe, it's mostly fresh right from the farm, you know.
Well, you must not only have a healthy appetite. I mean, the fact that you do something you totally love. You look 20 years younger than you are, and you sound 40 years younger than
you
are.
Thank you.
You just look and sound terrific.
Can I tell you something?
Yes.
The dream never stops. I never stop dreaming about what I want to do, what I have yet to do, and what I would love to do. And I never stop considering how lucky I am that I get to do music. I get up, and you can't see my studio here, but I have my Steinway piano here, and I get up every morning and I go to the piano, you know, and I never stop feeling fortunate that I can do that and earn my living this way.
Not just a joy you give yourself. It's a joy you give us by the work that it is that you do. God bless the artist, really. And people like Danny who find the artists and bring them to us and, with all our talent and their glory and their intelligence. It's wonderful. So you said The train is still running. Where's the next depot?
I love that. So I actually have two musicals I just completed. One with Alain Boublil, who wrote a little show called Les Miserables. And he also wrote Miss Saigon.
Oh my God.
We have a wonderful collaboration. We wrote a new show, a new idea based on Alain's called Ain't That Jazz. And we're very excited about it. And we'll see how that develops. You know, theater, actually right now at this moment, there's a lot of interest in it as a musical motion picture. So we redid it as a film as opposed to as a stage musical. But I think it would be a stage musical as well. But we'll see how that develops. You know,
mentioned the title, the word had jazz. I think one of the really excellent musical movies was Bob Fosse's All That Jazz.
Oh, it was great. Bob Fosse was incredible. This is a very, very different kind of a story. This is, without giving it away, it deals with jazz, but it also deals with Paris in the 1970s in America and New York and a love relationship that... with a lot of very unusual twists and turns. Alain is a wonderful book writer and a marvelous lyricist, and we have a wonderful collaboration.
Earlier, I mentioned that you and I lived through the same era of great black and white movies with fantastic composers. Of the few fantastic composers in movies, who were three or four of your favorites? And did any one of them influence you or just inspire you?
Well, among my good friends and composers, one of my closest friends was Jerry Goldsmith. Uh-huh. Jerry Goldsmith, who did 200 films. He wrote The Omen.
Yes.
Star Trek the motion picture.
He did all the Star Trek's motion picture. One of the greatest composers of all time in Hollywood. Of course, John Williams is fantastic. You know, I mean, I can't say I didn't grow up on their music. We became friends. Uh-huh. But Alfred Newman, for example, is one of the most wonderful composers. Korngold. There were some marvelous composers but truthfully, my background was not in trying to emulate the composers. Those days, as you say, black and white films, most of them came from Europe.
Yes.
Most of them came from a different kind of symphonic character nature, you know. I was more influenced in my youth by the contemporary music. I'm not talking about rock and roll, but I'm talking about contemporary jazz. Even the Beatles, Bacharach, you know, people whose work kind of emulated the time that we were living through. And when I started to do pictures, I just used all of the utensils I had. I had the palette, you know, I have the musical palette.
Well, the amazing thing, Charles, about your work, it transcends the society in which you grew up in. I mean, I look at a society, I must say, that is on the verge of deteriorating. I mean, I came from television where once upon a time we had such a thing as a fairness doctrine, we had equal time, all of which existed. We had a free press, which no longer exists at all. If you're 30 years of age in this country, you don't know what a free press is. But your music grows while the society around you seems to be shrinking. Do you feel that way?
You know, I love opportunities to do new things. I love challenges. I've done some ballets, you know, for the San Francisco Ballet Company, and like my collaborator, Michael Smuin, who was head of the company that commissioned me to write this ballet based on a Native American theme called The Song for Dead Warriors. And wow. So when we got into doing that ballet, we went together to to Missoula, Montana. We spent a few days on an Indian reservation. I read a lot of books about the Native Americans. I listened to a lot of their records. I went to American Indian Movement meetings with Russell Means.
Oh, my gosh, how interesting.
So just to absorb the characters, just to absorb the people, to feel the empathy. Some of the most beautiful writings really came from Native Americans, Chief Joseph and Red Cloud even. So I absorbed all this. And then when I started to write music, I put it aside and wrote my own music.
Yeah, you were the musician to the Pope, and now you're the musician to Red Cloud, okay?
That's but I love that. I love those.
Oh, my God, that's wonderful. Is his visit, Danny, to the Indian Nation and being with Russell Means, is any of that in your documentary?
Well, we hope to, yes. It's a great story.
Oh, my gosh. So are you in the middle of shooting that documentary now or in the middle of editing it?
I think we're I would say, at the tail end of shooting it, and we're well into editing it. So we're sort of simultaneously working both sides.
And what are you going to call it?
Right now, what's resonating is, you know, Charlie could give you the full name, but what I really like is the musical journeys, plural, of Charles Fox.
Oh, my God. That's the perfect title. That is absolutely the perfect title. And when do you expect it to be released? Will it be released theatrically, or will it go on one HBO or Showtime again?
Well, this time, what we did with this film is we're doing it completely independently so we can finish our creative thought, and then we'll enter the marketplace.
Oh, well, good.
But our goal is first theatrical.
Well, oh my gosh, I think that's just absolutely fantastic.
I'm having the time of my life, by the way, doing this, you know, revisiting places I've been. We were in Paris, so Danny said, I think it'd be a great idea if you do an evening in a jazz club.
Oh, that would be wonderful. But you know what? If there's not a song called that, write one. The Time of My Life. I mean, you could do that overnight over a cocktail, for crying out loud, as talented as you are. Yeah, my God almighty.
Wait, let me write that down. Okay, I got it.
Because, you know, to me, sadly, oh, I love listening to your song again. I love listening to Roberta Flack again, the other song that just tears me apart when I listen to it besides yours, is The First Time Ever I Saw Your Face.
Well, I wish I could take, I could take Count, I didn't write that one, you know that.
But I know you didn't write that one, but.
I wish I had, but I mean.
It is.
No one asked me.
It is a beautiful song. But
it is, yeah.
What I feel now is America no longer has romantic, they don't write love songs anymore. I mean, that's another title for another song. They don't write love songs anymore. The only place now, it seems, Charles, where you can hear a song, I mean, in the 30s and 40s and 50s, even the 60s, when they were writing ballads, they were like, because you said you were a music storyteller.
Yeah.
And when Sinatra, I was Sinatra's private writer for 4.5 years. He said he never chose the music. He always chose the lyrics because lyrics told the story. He believed in telling a story when he sang a song. And in those 4 decades, they were mini stories in these great love songs. Yeah. I don't hear that anymore in America, except in country music. The only place you can go now in country music.
You know, I think you're right. Country music has always loved songs that have songs with stories and love songs. And they still very much like, country music still has very much a pop flavor to it, if not real country. And they like to tell stories, that's true. I was very lucky in my life to work with some of the greatest lyricists. And so if truth be told, I prefer to work to a lyric. I've worked with different ways with different people, starting with You know, Sammy Kahn was once asked, I wrote songs with Sammy Kahn too. Sammy Kahn was once asked, what comes first, the music or the lyrics? And he says, the phone call.
And one of your more popular words, the words of the Pope came first. That's true. You're working with Hal David now on something, aren't you?
Well, I wish I were. Hal was a dear friend. Hal did pass away a number of years ago.
Oh, gosh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. We still see his lovely...
Who was his partner?
Bert Bacharach.
Yeah, Bacharach. But I never thought that Bacharach gave Hal David the credit he deserved. I hate to say that about Hal because he was written some wonderful songs. But when I had my show years ago on ABC, Hal came on as a guest and Bert wouldn't come on as a guest to be with him, which I thought was awful because Hal's lyrics were just fabulous, as was Bert's music.
Well, I mean, I can tell you that Bert very much loved Hal's lyrics. And they were a great combination together. And Hal didn't suffer any loss of any fame. I mean, everyone knew how great Hal David was. He was also, by the way, the president of ASCAP for many years. And he was, you know, the difference is Hal wasn't really a performer, although now and then he did, he did sing a song or two of his, you know. One time we wrote a song for one of the shows we did. Hal and I did a lot of, we wrote maybe 50 or 60 songs together over the years. And we were going out for dinner and my wife and I went to pick him up and his wife said, let me hear one of the songs that you've been working on. So I said, all right, let's do the duet. I'll sing this, you sing that. And then, so we finished doing that, the two songs, and he said, usually with Bert, I didn't get to sing.
And now the president of ASCAP is Paul Williams.
Yes. Now, so Paul is another dear friend. Paul's in this movie too, by the way.
Oh, he is. Tell me about your meeting with Paul, because I was a very close friend of Paul's for a couple of years in Los Angeles, and I was his opening act at the Universal Amphitheater.
Oh, really? I didn't know that. Oh.
Yeah, when I was doing a stand-up. Anyway, tell us about if you have a chance, if you go to my website, www.johnbarbersworld.com, you will see the best interview Paul Williams ever did on television. I mean, he was adorable. And then he crashed for about 10 years into drugs and all kinds of stuff and had the most amazing recovery and ended up now being the president of ASCAP. So tell me about putting Paul in the film, Dan.
Well, I mean, Paul plays a significant role in Charlie's career, both.
In what way?
Well, I mean, they wrote the music, the songs for the film One-on-One with Robbie Benson.
Really?
We wrote The Love Boat together.
The Love Boat, of course.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
And actually, they wrote a song for the last film. Not the last film, the film before the last film called The Bronx, USA. Charlie and Paul wrote a song called Da Bronx, which got shortlisted for Oscar consideration.
And oh, my God. And, career was a bank commercial. Started with a bank commercial. We've only just begun.
Yeah, yeah. That was just one of those things that you never expect in life. He wrote this beautiful song and became a commercial. Paul is one of the great songwriters of all time. And Paul is one of my dearest friends, too. We've written a number of songs together. And I'm really proud of Paul. I always tell him, what he's accomplished in his life. Because he now represents 450,000 music composers and publishers and lyricists and authors, and he has brought so much to the value of one's music, he's great and continues to write his beautiful songs. And
you worked with him and wrote those wonderful songs is fabulous. Now I could never imagine you getting into a position of being a corporate president. I can only imagine you at a piano all day long.
I'll take that image. Thank you very much. But if you want to know the truth, I was also, for a number of years, the governor of the Motion Picture Academy, representing the music branch of the Academy. Yeah.
Oh, good for you. So
I didn't leave my piano chair to do that.
Well, honest to goodness, I can't tell you how thrilled I am. I'm just a total lover of music. My wife sang when Earl Father Hines left the Louis Armstrong Sextet because he didn't like Louis' lifestyle, and he moved to San Francisco and he had a big band. My wife became his singer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's your age, Charles, and she still sounds like Ella Fitzgerald. I just am a junkie for music. It's true. I don't care what Socrates said about an unexamined life is not worth living. It's not worth living if it doesn't have music like yours in it and creative people like you in it. So I cannot thank you and Danny enough for spending this day after Memorial Day here with me. I just loved it. So thank you.
Thank you too, John. I've enjoyed it too. I'm sure Danny has.
It.
And as I say, I've been a fan of yours for many years. So I'm happy to see you maybe one day, not just on Zoom, but meet again in person.
Oh,
I would love to do that.
And okay, what I would love to do is trade books. I'm going to go get your book, Killing Me Softly. I'm going to order it from Amazon.
Okay.
But if you and Danny give Harlan your post office box or home address, I'm going to send you a copy of my autobiography. It's called Your Mother's Not a Virgin, The Bumpy Life and Times of the Canadian Dropout Who Changed the Face of American Television. I will tell you, as a former critic, it is by far the best book ever written about anybody in show business. So,
well, if you can start off laughing with the title of the book, you know there's a good book beyond that.
Well, thank you again so much. And oh my gosh, good luck. And if I were religious, I'd say God bless, but I'll say it anyway. God bless both of you. And thank you all for watching. And we'll see you again in another 2 weeks with another wonderful Talking Movies.